Hi, this is Eric Ruderman from Northwestern University in Chicago, and I want to welcome you to RA Month on Room Now. Today, I'm going to be debating Dr. Oren Traum on the appropriate use of imaging in rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm going to see if I can persuade you that routine imaging is really not any longer appropriate in rheumatoid arthritis, and he's going to try to persuade you in the alternative. Mind you, I'm not opposed to any imaging in rheumatoid arthritis when appropriate. It's just routine imaging that I'm going to argue against because I don't believe it has any value anymore. Historically, we used radiographs as a way to assess for erosions and bony change in the joints in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And structural change was really used as a surrogate for loss of function over time, which is why the FDA has always seen value in using radiographic change as a biomarker of structural change and hence ultimately functional change, as functional limitations can be driven by structural damage in the long term, just as they are driven by inflammation and pain in the short term. However, all of this dates to an era in rheumatoid arthritis in which our patients sustained significant structural damage. And once we started to use methotrexate routinely in the early 1980s and then eventually biologic therapy, we no longer see that. We no longer have patients with dramatic structural damage over time. And so I think the world has changed. It's very reasonable to get radiographs at baseline. The presence of erosive disease, just like very elevated acute phase reactants or high titers of rheumatoid factor or anti-CCP antibodies, can indicate patients who should be treated more aggressively in order to minimize disease damage over time and the impact of the disease. However, I don't think there's any longer a role for routine monitoring of radiographs. Those of you who've been at this for a while may remember that in the past, we used to do annual x-rays on patients, and the goal was really to document progressive damage. Unfortunately, that was in an age when we saw progressive damage, but really couldn't do anything to mitigate it. Now, we have so few patients who are not well controlled with medication, which is our goal of therapy, that they don't have damage, and it's just not worth it to do regular x-rays anymore. And when there is progression that we see over time, it's really that so few patients have any meaningful progression that it's really not a useful parameter to follow. When we look at x-ray change over time in clinical trials, there is very little change over time. And often we're looking at differences of one or two sharp units, which is barely a half an erosion. And for the patients who have more than that, it's a handful of patients in a large trial. In addition, many of the clinical trials, particularly with the TNF inhibitors, have now shown that even that small amount of progression is really blocked with treatment and with therapy, even in those patients who don't have a full clinical response. So we have drugs that reduce and block even the small amount of radiographic progression that we now see over time. And finally, and I think importantly, when there is some progression on x-rays, there is absolutely no data to suggest that any one agent is better than another at reducing that progression, nor that a change in treatment would make any difference. So I would never change therapy in a patient who's clinically doing well just because they have progression on their radiographs. And the first rule of any diagnostic testing, including x-rays, is never order a test if you don't intend to act on what you find. Now, I will add a caveat here. MRI and ultrasound, more advanced imaging techniques, may have some value in determining whether a given patient's disease is clinically active when you're not really sure. On the other hand, MRI findings of erosions, which are sometimes reported, have never been well correlated with any true progressive structural damage. So I don't think MRI is of any value if that is your goal in doing them. Dr. Traum will tell you that imaging can help you guide therapy. And I suppose in some isolated circumstances, that may be true. However, I do think that the ongoing focus on radiographic image and radiographic change that's driven in part by industry trying to get structural damage claims into their labeling has really distracted us from our primary goal of clinical and functional remission in rheumatoid arthritis. And that is where we should be focusing our efforts.
Hello, I'm Oren Traum, and I'm in Santa Monica, California. And my task was to talk about the utility of imaging in rheumatoid arthritis. And I'll speak about three things. One, when are x-rays appropriate or needed in evaluating patients with RA? Is there a value to serial, repeated, or annual imaging? And is there value in that? And when or if advanced imaging, such as ultrasound or MRI, should be incorporated into the evaluation and care of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. I'll start with the first in regard to conventional radiography or x-rays. And I think times have changed. When I first was doing my training back in the early 1980s, the American College of Rheumatology and others encouraged annual x-rays to find changes in patients that had rheumatoid arthritis if they were progressing with joint space narrowing and erosions, looking at sharp scoring. But since the availability of advanced therapies, which really have revolutionized the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, I don't think that's necessary because conventional radiography really doesn't change that much if patients are put on appropriate therapies, methotrexate, typically the anchor drug, in other countries, maybe sulfasalazine. But then the availability of biologic therapies and targeted synthetic small molecules have really made such a significant difference in patients' lives with rheumatoid arthritis that x-ray changes really don't change that much. And I think patients should really be followed with other measures, disease activity measures. And if they're in remission or low disease activity, multiple studies have shown that there's very, very little change that would be considered significant in patients' conventional radiography. I do think that they should be done in the beginning at the initial evaluation of a patient with rheumatoid arthritis, just to get a baseline of where someone is. And that may be useful and maybe even preempt the necessity for other advanced imaging. The second is there value to serial or repeated annual imaging, whether it be x-rays or other imaging? And I've just spoken to the issue of regular x-rays, and I don't think there is value in that if patients are being monitored with some measurement. I use the CDI in my office, but the SDI, Rapid 3, whatever you're using, at least there's some measurement to make sure patients are in low disease activity or hopefully remission. And then the third, when or if advanced imaging, and in particular MRI or ultrasound, are warranted. Over 20 years ago, I started using actually an extremity MRI to evaluate the patient's hands, wrists, and feet of folks that had inflammatory arthritis. And as had already been published, Mikkel Ostergaard, Phil Conahan, Paul Emery in Europe had noted that X-rays were okay, but advanced imaging such as MRI were twice as sensitive for picking up erosions. And the added value of seeing osteitis or bone marrow edema led to really better imaging and more information that helped the rheumatologist or healthcare provider in assessing the severity or potential severity of patients that had rheumatoid arthritis. So the hope would be that you got to a patient before they had erosions, and osteitis was the best predictor of future erosions, but it also picked up synovitis, later incorporated into the RAMRIS or RA MRI scoring, was tenosynovitis, synovitis, osteitis. All of these measures helped in the early evaluation of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. In Europe and then in the United States and other parts of the world, ultrasound became very popular because of its availability, the lower cost compared to MRI, where MRI also is not available everywhere, And it also helped in evaluating patients early for synovitis and for effusions and for erosions, and better than conventional radiography. So my thought now is that using advanced imaging should be used early. Whether or not you use it on a serial basis to determine whether or not someone's getting better, that may be best used in research studies, not so much necessarily in clinical practice, although ultrasound can be used to determine whether or not someone is getting better. It's also useful, both ultrasound and MR, in the differential diagnosis of an inflammatory arthritis that hasn't really unfolded as classic rheumatoid arthritis. The other area that I think advanced imaging is important is in the patient that has what is called clinically significant arthralgia, or a patient that may be predisposed to rheumatoid arthritis because they have an elevated CCP or rheumatoid factor and have arthralgias, but no clinical evidence on physical exam of synovitis or arthritis. And I think this has been shown to be useful in predicting who may then develop rheumatoid arthritis. There are other studies that would say that that would be a controversial thing to do on a follow-up evaluation, like the Arctic study. But I think this can be very helpful for evaluating patients and in the differential diagnosis of patients that may ultimately get rheumatoid arthritis. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Jack Cush from Dallas, Texas. I want to talk to you about serologies and RA. Does it really matter that you're seropositive or seronegative? And if it does, how so? You know, rheumatoid factor is how we all sort of got into seropositivity and the marker, if you will, for rheumatoid arthritis. It's been around for, you know, back in the 30s, antibodies were found that were linked to rheumatoid arthritis. Initially, it was by Rose and Waller. It became the Rose-Waller test. Had a lot of specificity, not so much good sensitivity. Later became the sensitized sheep cell agglutination assay. We now know that rheumatoid factor positivity seen in roughly 80% of patients. That equates to over 20 million Americans who are rheumatoid factor positive. But we know rheumatoid factor, very sensitive, not quite as specific as anti-CCP antibodies or ACPA antibodies. We do know that rheumatoid factor seropositivity doesn't relate to disease activity, whereas ACPA does. ACPA relates to both risk and severity and disease activity. We do know for both rheumatoid factor and ACPA, the higher the titer, the greater the concern, especially when it comes to ACPA and the development of RA in people who may be at risk. Rheumatoid factor is seen in people who may not have rheumatoid arthritis. And we deal with this as in doing consults all the time, especially people with chronic lung disease. I'm going to say that again. Chronic lung disease, ILD, bronchiectasis, even COPD, those patients have a higher risk of rheumatoid factors that are not pathogenic, that are not a marker for RA unless they have synovitis. This often gets confused when they have OA, chronic lung disease, and they're seropositive, and you're calling in to judge that. It's seen also in chronic liver disease and chronic renal disease with infections, especially parasitic infections, and with neoplasia. CCP is not uncommonly seen also in chronic lung disease, especially ILD. It can be seen in people who have the antisynthetase syndrome, and up to 15% of patients with psoriatic arthritis will have CCP antibodies. We do know that seronegativity is common, and for that reason, you need to have a strategy regarding seronegativity. I think seronegativity means this is different. I mean, it looks like rheumatoid, smells like rheumatoid, responds like rheumatoid, but it's different. And hence, you should always, with seronegative RA, be considering another diagnosis. It's your invitation to do so. The problem with seronegative RA is it's not studied as well. Often these patients are excluded from clinical trials. They're not often represented well in population-based studies. there are greater delays in the diagnosis, so they don't get onto your clinic agenda as readily as seropositives may. So, like, what can this be? Seronegatives can be a lot of different things. I like to say that, you know, it could be PMR, it can be chikungunya, it can be rheumatoid arthritis as a result of checkpoint inhibitor therapy for cancer. A Finnish study done by Tuulikki Soukka a number of years ago looked at 435 patients with seronegative RA. They found that with a long follow-up, only 3% of them evolved into clear-cut RA, meaning they had erosions or they became seropositive. Only 3%. Two-thirds went on to show themselves to be another diagnosis. Lead amongst those was 16% with PMR, 20% with SPA, meaning either ankylosing spondylitis or psoriatic arthritis, 10% with OA, and 4% with pseudogout or CPPD disease. That accounts for about 50% of that two-thirds. One-third of patients never changed their designation, hence they remained seronegative RA. It's important to think about this when you're seeing these patients. Seronegative RA patients actually have to, and usually do, manifest higher levels of disease activity at diagnosis. Think about it. They don't have the benefit of seropositivity to make the diagnosis. So they often have to make up with that by having more disease or more active disease. Whether they have more remissions or not is kind of debated in the literature. So what does seronegative mean? Does it mean it's self-limiting? Does it mean there's a misdiagnosis? Does it mean that it's just a chronic form of arthritis and I don't know what else to call it? Again, I think these are questions that you need to know. Lastly, it turns out that seronegatives respond to therapy just as well as seropositives, and that's important to know. Seropositivity, as I said, dates back to the 1930s. We do know seropositivity confers certainty of diagnosis. It homogenizes the patients that you call rheumatoid arthritis and hence makes them really good candidates for studies. As I said earlier, causes of rheumatoid factor positivity could be age, sarcoid, pulmonary fibrosis, parasites, PBC, primary biliary cirrhosis, cryoglobulinemia, etc. ACPA, we said, can also occur in chronic lung disease. But know that having ACPA, if you don't yet have RA, confers about a 30 to 60% risk of developing RA. And the higher the titer, the more likely. Obviously, it gets closer to 60 if you're a first-degree relative, if you have more than just arthralgias, like having either an abnormal MR or ultrasound or an elevated acute phase reactant. Again, it confers specificity of diagnosis, and it imparts a severity. Higher titers and multiplicity of autoantibodies that suggest rheumatoid arthritis are almost always associated with more severe disease. Having ACPA, especially in higher titers, means more X-ray damage and erosions, higher mortality rates, less chance at remission. And again, we all know that these autoantibodies exist for 10, even 15 years, but usually 10 years before. Hence, the question is, are they pathogenic? We really don't know that. There isn't a lot of evidence that these cause disease directly, but we do know that these can be found in people with preclinical RA in the sputum, in the lung, found in bronchoalveolar lavage, and finding ACPA antibodies in the lung, which I think is one of the earliest signs of RA, increases the odds that that person is going to progress to clinically manifest RA with swollen joints. Lastly, there's an advantage here to the serologies. If you're seropositive, you can have a 10 to 20% higher response if you use rituximab, evidence from the reflex study, or abatacept, evidence from, my goodness, from the APIPRA study, the ARIA study, the ASCEND study. There's a whole bunch of studies with abatacept. And lastly, I think there's mounting evidence that seropositivity gives you an augmented response if you use a JAK inhibitor. I cannot say the same about seropositivity influencing the response of people taking either methotrexate, DMARDs, hydroxychloroquine, TNF inhibitors, or IL-6 inhibitors. So again, it is valuable to get serologies. I do recommend that you get rheumatoid factor and CCP. I don't know the value of CAR-P antibodies or 14-33-ADA, but I do recommend those two because I think it will help shape your thinking and tell you what you should be thinking about when following these patients. Take care.
Hello, I'm Mike Weinblatt from the Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston. And today I'm going to talk about some issues regarding the most common drug we use for rheumatoid arthritis, that being methotrexate. I'm going to spend some time talking about issues regarding dosing of methotrexate, and then also my bias and impressions regarding how to monitor for safe use of the drug. So as everybody knows, methotrexate's been the standard of care for rheumatoid arthritis. It is the number one disease-modifying therapy we use worldwide in the treatment of RA. However, many rheumatologists still today are probably not using the best dose of the drug. And this is a study from 5 years ago that Jim O'Dell and colleagues performed looking at an insurance data set of over 36,000 patients with RA managed in the United States, starting between 2009 and 2012. And in this study, it was noted that there was only a modest increase in methotrexate use from 15.3 to 15.9 milligrams per week, and 13% of the patients switched to subcutaneous therapy. It's important to note that only 37% of the patients were on a methotrexate dose of greater than 15 milligrams per week prior to starting a biologic. And why is that important? It's important because the therapeutic dose of methotrexate is somewhere between 15 and 25 milligrams per week. So many patients are starting on more expensive therapies before they actually get to a therapeutic dose of methotrexate. Now, how do I use the drug? I generally start patients at a dose between 10 and 20 milligrams per week. In my practice, I'm generally starting at 12.5 milligrams per week. Some of my European colleagues start at 20. I think it really depends upon tolerability issues. It takes at least 4 weeks to begin to note an effect of the drug, and that's due because methotrexate is a monoglutamate compound, and it's polyglutamated to its active form inside the cell. And we need to increase the dose for therapeutic effects. So in my practice, I start at 12.5 milligrams per week, and 4 to 5 weeks later, if the patient's tolerating the medicine, and I will generally increase the dose somewhere to 20 to 25 milligrams per week. There have been several studies that have shown that there's limited value in increasing the methotrexate dose above 25 milligrams per week. Now, as you increase the dose of methotrexate above 17.5 milligrams per week, you lose absorption of the drug and you decrease drug levels. And that's the reason why subcutaneous methotrexate is so effective. And additionally, if you don't want to switch to sub-Q methotrexate, you could split the dose of methotrexate and giving it morning and night, one day a week. What many of you may not recall is that when we did our first studies with methotrexate in the 1980s, we used split dose methotrexate. We used the dermatology pulse regimen where we dosed 8 a.m., 8 p.m., and 8 a.m. They did it because they thought it would affect skin kinetics, which is not correct. But in essence, they were doing the right thing by splitting the dose to improve absorption. And there have been several small studies that have demonstrated that split-dose oral methotrexate achieves the same serum concentrations as sub-Q methotrexate. So once you get patients up to a therapeutic dose, somewhere between 17.5 to 25 milligrams per week, patients will begin to respond within 4 weeks, but a maximum effect may take as long as 12 weeks. In someone who's doing great on the drug, you can begin to slowly reduce the drug over time. I generally maintain the therapeutic dose for 3 to 6 months, and then I gradually reduce the dose by 2.5 milligram increments every month. Now, the American College of Rheumatology has come out with guidelines on the use of methotrexate. This is a committee for which I had the pleasure of being on, for which we had many patients involved. And the patient advocates actually recommended oral therapy over sub-Q therapy initially. Our colleagues in Europe and in Canada, many of them start with sub-Q therapy. And we generally recommend titrating the dose of the drug so that within, 4 to 8 weeks, you're on a dose of drug that's above 15 milligrams per week. It's really important that you get the dose up to a therapeutic dose before you add another therapy. If you're increasing the dose, or when you're increasing the dose above 15 milligrams per week, either switch to sub-Q therapy or give it split dose oral, morning and night, one day a week. Splitting the dose over a week, such as a Monday-Thursday regimen, historically has been associated with more bone marrow toxicity and liver toxicity. Methotrexate actually works very effectively as a monotherapy, with 30% of patients on methotrexate alone going into low disease activity or remission. And it's important to note that methotrexate increases the efficacy of several of our biologics, including anti-TNF therapy, rituximab, and abatacept. In the case of infliximab and adalimumab, methotrexate increases the drug levels of the monoclonal by 20 to 25%. Now, the question is, what dose of methotrexate do you need to be on to get this effect? And there's been at least two studies now with adalimumab in which the methotrexate dose had to be at least 10 milligrams per week to achieve this positive benefit. And with an infliximab, in the only study where this was examined, a dose of methotrexate of 7.5 milligrams per week was sufficient. In a patient who you've placed in low disease activity or remission with methotrexate and a biologic, I generally, over time, try to lower the dose of methotrexate, particularly for tolerability reasons. And the lowest dose of methotrexate I will go down to as I taper is a dose of 10 milligrams per week. Let's talk now and switch gears and talk about monitoring. And what are we most interested in monitoring for? We're most interested in monitoring methotrexate effects on the liver. The only long-term toxicity of methotrexate is liver disease. We know that there's a high incidence of liver toxicity in patients with psoriasis. In a recent study that's come out of the Scandinavian countries, out of Denmark, there was a much higher rate of liver toxicity in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis as compared to rheumatoid arthritis. And Joel Kremer and I have been studying the effects of methotrexate on the liver for more than 30 years. And we have reported that the risk of serious liver disease at 5 years in a cohort study was less than 1 out of 1,000. I actually think it's much lower than this. In this cohort study, a case-controlled trial in patients who had serious liver disease defined as either biopsy evidence of cirrhosis or in patients with evidence of portal hypertension or ascites or esophageal varices, all of the patients had abnormal liver blood tests a year prior to the seminal event. And by abnormal liver blood tests, we're talking about any level of transaminase above the upper limit of normal or the development of low serum albumin. Based upon this, we have recommended routine monitoring of liver blood tests and considering a FibroScan in patients with persistent abnormalities or recurrent abnormalities in AST and ALT or developing a low serum albumin, and then biopsying when the tests are abnormal. So with monitoring at baseline, and this is based upon a lot of years of work and now in our guidelines, we recommend at baseline prior to starting methotrexate, a complete blood count, AST, ALT, and albumin, a serum creatinine, since the drug is 100% cleared by the kidney, and to screen for the presence of hepatitis B and C. And we do TB testing at that time, since many of our patients end up going on a biologic, and considering a chest x-ray in patients with risk for lung disease or with underlying lung disease. We recommend that patients not start methotrexate if they have the AST and ALT above the upper limit of normal. So the liver transaminase should be normal prior to starting methotrexate. There have been case reports in patients who had unrecognized hepatitis B or C infection that started methotrexate, and when methotrexate was withdrawn, they developed fulminant hepatitis. So that's one of the reasons we recommend screening for B or C prior to starting the drug. Routine laboratory monitoring is recommended by our professional society every 8 to 12 weeks, and our original recommendation were recommended every 8 weeks. It's now been extended out to 12. There's been a recent paper that was published that suggests that you could basically reduce your monitoring in patients over time. And I absolutely don't agree with this. Methotrexate liver disease occurs with chronic therapy, not in the first 6 months, not in the first 9 months. It's something you've seen after years of treatment. And what you're looking for are subtle changes in liver blood tests above the upper limit of normal. Not one-fold, not two-fold, not three-fold. It's anything above the upper limit of normal of the AST and ALT. And if you see that repetitively over the course of 6 to 12 months, that's when you should consider getting a fibro scan. Sometimes I'll hold their methotrexate, I'll lower their NSAIDs, I'll lower their methotrexate dose, and repeat the blood test. Chronic liver disease should not occur with methotrexate therapy if we appropriately monitor. Now, who's at risk for liver disease for methotrexate? Patients with elevated BMIs are probably the greatest factor in liver toxicity because patients who are morbidly obese have a higher risk of fatty liver, and fatty liver predisposes to hepatic fibrosis. So that's the patients that we should be most cautious about. Insulin-dependent diabetics have a higher risk of NASH, and we need to be concerned about. And patients with significant alcohol consumption are at a greater risk for liver toxicity because of the effects of alcohol on the liver. Those are the three major groups at risk for methotrexate toxicity. Overall, how do we reduce side effects from methotrexate in addition to monitoring? Give patients supplemental folic acid, 1 to 2 milligrams per day, to reduce some of the nuisance side effects, such as mouth sores, headaches, diarrhea, and perhaps nausea, as well as fatigue. And in patients who still have side effects despite folic acid, I go to folinic acid or leucovorin, starting with a dose of 5 milligrams given 8 to 12 hours after the methotrexate. If you dose leucovorin within the half pharmacological half-life of the drug, you will actually block the effectiveness of methotrexate. And if patients still have the side effect despite 5 milligrams of folinic acid, I increase the dose regularly until I can reduce that side effect. So by careful consideration of our patients, by doing pre-screening prior to starting methotrexate, by monitoring these patients on a regular basis, we can avoid many of the side effects. The other important lab test to monitor is your creatinine, because the drug's 100% cleared by the kidney. So if patients get unrecognized renal disease, and I define that as a GFR of less than 30, they will not clear methotrexate, and over time, they're at risk for bone marrow suppression, which could include pancytopenia. So these are some important pearls to think about when you're using methotrexate. And as I noted, methotrexate is the standard of care worldwide in the treatment of RA. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Dr. Artie Cavanaugh, and I'm happy to join you here on Room Now. The topic of this discussion is difficult to treat rheumatoid arthritis. An interesting topic, and it's hard not to hearken back to the Judge Potter Stewart said in 1964 in the case of Jacobulus versus Ohio. He said, "I may not be able to define it, but I know it when I see it." Of course, he was talking about movie pornography, but I think that's the way a lot of rheumatologists feel about difficult to treat rheumatoid arthritis. I don't know how to define it, and people are starting to think about defining it, but I certainly know it when I see it, and I think that's the way most of us feel. What is difficult to treat rheumatoid arthritis? Well, I think we could flip that around and say, what is easy to treat rheumatoid arthritis? Fred Wolf said that about fibromyalgia. Years ago, the ACR asked him to give a presentation on difficult to treat fibromyalgia, and he said, "I don't know how to treat easy to treat fibromyalgia." I think for our rheumatoids, we're blessed with a large number of therapeutic options these days. Back in the day, we had gold injections and sulfasalazine and that new drug methotrexate, and that was it. So a lot of our patients were difficult to treat. We didn't have many options. Now we have lots of options, but we still have patients where we're not achieving the goals. And of course, the more therapies that we've had, the higher the goals of therapy have become. Indeed, we want remission for all of our patients. What How many patients do achieve that? How many easy to treat RA patients? I don't think it's that many. I think maybe 25% of patients, and easy to treat to me means you get on their first drug, rarely hydroxychloroquine, more often methotrexate, sometimes methotrexate and a TNF inhibitor, sometimes other mechanisms, and they do great. They don't have synovitis. They come and see you and their checkups are quite easy. They're tolerating the medicine. But that means the rest of the patients are difficult to treat by definition. What makes them difficult to treat? Well, I think many of us would agree from an immunologic standpoint, there are patients who have persistent synovitis and we've given them good tries of many medications and they still have persistent abundant synovitis. Those people, seropositive in general, often with extra-articular manifestations, have been on therapy after therapy. There's no particular number to me that says it's difficult to treat rheumatoid arthritis, but we know that there are those patients out there. But I think that's more a smaller subset. The difficult to treat is more of a complex construct to me than just that immune construct. I think it has to do with a lot more of the doctor characteristics and the patient characteristics. Certainly, we work with our patients. We don't prescribe drugs to them. We give them choices and we work with them to pick the choices. And we all know that there are patients who have difficulties with medications. I think my heart sinks if I read a chart for a patient I've not seen before and they're allergic to 20 different medications. I know that the chances I'm going to find a medication that they've not been on that's going to work are going to be relatively small. And I've also learned over the years for our younger viewers, back when I was young and knew everything, I would often engage the patients and say, well, you know, this shouldn't make your teeth itch. I don't know that I've never seen that before. It doesn't matter. If they think it makes their teeth itch, they're not going to take it. We're also frustrated, I think, difficult to treat when we see charts where patients have been on one medicine after another and perhaps only 1 or 2 months of a trial. In that case, I'm not sure that we would define that as a failure. Still, the patient is difficult to treat. The biggest issue, a big issue, is the compliance with medications. And when I have younger trainees, sometimes they'll wonder what's going on. Why do I ask the patient 2 and 3 times about the medicines that they're taking and what day they're taking it and what does it look like? Because there's nothing, no medicine that's going to fail like a medicine that the person is not taking. So compliance or having the patient actively participate in the choices is super important. So to me, this is why difficult to treat rheumatoid arthritis is such a tough issue because it involves potential immune contributions, doctor characteristics, and patient characteristics. We have lots of choices, but we still have patients that we need to do better with. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jack Cush with Room Now, talking to you about my approach to difficult to treat RA, D2TRA, as it is known in the biz. You already saw Artie Kavanaugh's great video where he talked about considerations. And I like that he gave you a big piece on considerations instead of, you know, all the new molecules, all the future therapies and whatnot, because I think he and I both believe that while those could be an option for some people, they're not the answer for the majority of people. Difficult to treat RA is a complex thing. It encompasses a lot of different kinds of patients. You know, and he said, I know it when I see it. There are actually are definitions of D2TRA put forward by EULAR. The lead author was Nagy. My book talks about this. It's basically failure of 2 or more biologic or targeted synthetic DMARDs after having tried a conventional DMARD. And that there's signs of activity either with moderate disease activity, signs of active disease, inability to taper steroids, radiographic progressions, RA symptoms, and poor quality of life. And that the patient and doctor both agree that this is difficult to treat RA. You know, I think that my easy definition of D2TRA is it's when you cross that threshold of diminishing returns. The patient's been on 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 conventional oral DMARDs. They've been on more than 4 biologics, you know, giving another biologic or the drug you've never used, you really think that's going to work? It's not. The prevalence of this problem is large. in most large series, population series in your practice, it's about 10%. And that's a number that's shown up in three different studies. Dr. Cavanaugh was right. I think about 25% of our patients are easy, right? And then 10% are really difficult. And then there's another 60% who we struggle with, but you're pretty good at managing. And that's where you're expert. But it's these difficult to treat RA patients that are a problem. The problem is that there's no guidelines. Now, good, EULAR has a definition. And now we're starting to see studies that are evaluating different approaches and considerations. But if you look at the EULAR and the ACR guidelines from 21 and 22, nope, not really even addressed. You know the markers, the clinical features that characterize this population. They're older, they smoke, they're obese, lower socioeconomic groups, lower inadequate levels of education, many joints, nodules, vasculitis, acute phase reactants, high titer, ACPA, and RF, radiographic erosions. They may or may not have the genetic shared epitope. But again, that's really not, for me, the things that really characterize this population is not adherence to therapy, coming late into rheumatologic care, meaning a whole lot of damage was done before you ever got them. Bad genes, bad behaviors, wrong diagnoses. You're wanting to wean down their DMAR therapies. What are you thinking? The quest for monotherapy, equally nonsensical. The failure to change therapy, that's often your fault. And just flat out guessing about what to do next. You're now in the category. I'm making this easy for you. It's either the wrong diagnosis, the wrong drug, the wrong patient, or the wrong doctor. Wrong diagnosis. Consider the diagnosis. Misdiagnosis of RA happens, especially seronegative. Study of 435 seronegative patients showed that only a third of them went on to develop another diagnosis. Wait, no. I'm sorry. Two-thirds of them went on to develop another diagnosis, with half of those being PMR, pseudogout, osteoarthritis, and one of the seronegative spondyloarthropathies. But misdiagnosis is a frequent cause of what you're calling RA and any RA. Here's the features that unify these people. Think about this. Often seronegative. More atypical presentations. Longer time to diagnose. More DMAR failures. More biologic failures. More drug toxicities. Big red flag for each of those that you're dealing with another kind of patient and maybe the wrong diagnosis. Wrong drug, that's always a big thing. I'm shocked at the number of rheumatologists who have tried seven biologics and haven't tried the two or three remaining, who still want to try the two or three remaining, even though the patient failed everything in the past. I'm sorry, the patient's screaming, I'm not RA. Don't give me an RA-indicated biologic. My approach to therapeutics are consider other diagnoses, as I said, and the other things I'm going to say after this. If you really want a diagnostic approach, look at the blog I wrote on this called Difficult to Treat RA, where you take the control, alt, delete, meaning what drugs previously controlled the patient, prednisone, Enbrel, whatever. What drugs do you delete that they would never take again because it gave them itchy teeth? They're never going to take methotrexate again. They're never going to take leflunomide again. They're never going to take whatever it was, cyclosporine again. I don't care what the reason is. You don't fight them on stuff that is in their head. The story they're telling themselves is that drug doesn't work. And then the alternatives are the things that you haven't yet tried and hurt. And you could try a lot of different things. And again, I have my own list that's a little odd. You may have your list. But for instance, I like to use in difficult to treat patients, JAKs, rituximab, and weight loss, including bariatric surgery. Lastly, you get handcuffed on the wrong drug based on their side effects and comorbidities. Knowing what drugs you can safely use is the way to go there. If you don't know, ask someone else. I don't use experimental drugs, bortezomib, tacrolimus. I only use once. Vagal nerve stimulation, GM-CSF inhibitors, BTK. No, but I do use sometimes anakinra, gold, cyclophosphamide, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, apremilast, and IL-17. What, really? The latter three in patients who are seronegative. Lastly, the wrong patient. They're non-compliant, won't go, can't show, can't do, no shows. That's their message. Negativistic thinkers, diabolical negativism. I wrote about this. Poor patient managers, poor sleepers, people with anxiety, depression, chronic pain seekers, the vaccinots, magical thinkers, and different drummers. These people are hell on wheels. There's a lot of underlying depression, psychiatric, psychological disorders, and fibromyalgia. Deal with it, because giving them a biologic is not the solution. And lastly, the wrong doctor. Don't be afraid to get a second opinion. When you've done all you can do admit it, send them to your best buddy across town. So the checklist, ask the patient what they want. They'll tell you what they want. Use a team approach. If you're unsure about the pain and it might could be mechanical, do imaging to get to the bottom of pain to find out if it really is inflammatory or it's mechanical. Deal with depression and bad behaviors. Don't be handcuffed by safety limitations that you don't understand. Ask for help, right? Reboot the system. Control, Alt, Delete. And then rethink the diagnosis and get a second opinion. This is my approach to difficult to treat RA.